And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Who's the richest person in the world right now? Who is the richest person of all time throughout history? How does where you were born affect how much money you'll earn over a lifetime? And what does a country's income inequality indicate about that country's basic economic health, about its society? And why do these questions matter? My next guest, Branko Milanovic, tackles these questions and many others in his work. Branko Milanovic is a lead economist in the World Bank's research department, where he works on topics of income inequality and globalization. His most recent book is titled The Haves and the Have-Nots, A Brief and Idiosyncratic History of Global Inequality. Branko Milanovic joins me. Welcome to our program.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
We want to mention that you will be in Iowa next Monday to speak at Drake University, Monday, March 10th, about this very topic, the haves and the have-nots, global inequality. Social and economic inequality have been in our news a great deal in the past few months, specifically in regards to the growing disparity in income between rich and poor in this country. Give us an idea of the picture globally.
Well, globally, the picture in the last 20 to 25 years has changed because of the rapid growth rates of China and India in particular. And if you start with countries that were very poor, and they still remain poor, and they grow very fast, and although inequality within both China and India has increased, you still have lots of poor people who become relatively better off compared not only to their previous position, but compared to the other people in the rich world. And that tends to either stabilize global inequality or to reduce it, despite the fact that within each individual country there and each individual country in the West, you had generally increase in inequality.
So are you saying that over the last 20 years that inequality in the world has decreased because of the rise of the middle class in India and China, for instance?
Basically, that's the story. You know, it is obviously like every story which depends on so much on the data, it's more complex. But if I were to really summarize it in like two sentences, I would say that in most countries of the world, we have seen increases in their national inequalities, whereas in the world as a whole, we either had stable inequality or a slightly declining level of inequality.
Mm-hmm. So fit that global picture together with the inequality that is in the United States. How do they fit together?
Oh, of course, the gap, the difference is very large because the U.S. inequality, although it is today fairly high, it is much less than inequality in the world as a whole. And if I use a number which is called the Gini coefficient, which gives you this indication of inequality, in the U.S. it is now a little bit over 40, which is very high because in Western Europe it's about 35. But the global inequality is 70-plus. Mm-hmm. So this is a huge difference.
So while we talk about our inequality, it's not nearly the scale of most places in most countries in the world.
No. What I mentioned, the 70 is for the whole world as a whole, if you
yes.
take all individuals in the world. But if you take individual countries, then the story there is that the U.S. is a country with very high inequality compared to sort of its income peers, which is essentially Western Europe, Australia, Canada, New Zealand, Japan, and so forth. So U.S. is a country with high inequality. Mm. However, if you take the U.S. within the entire world and compare U.S. with Brazil and Argentina and Egypt and Russia and China, then the U.S. inequality is not so outstanding because these countries also have inequalities that are very high.
What are the drivers in the 21st century that increase or decrease the gap between wealthy and poor in the world?
Well, as we just said, you know, in the world as a whole, we basically have now probably slightly declining inequality. But it is useful to think of the drivers as essentially being three. The first one is whether poor countries are growing faster and slower than the rich countries. If the poor countries are increasing faster, their rate of growth is higher, that means that they are driving inequality down. Now, that's the first driver. The second driver is what happens to inequalities within nations, and we have seen that they have generally gone up. So that's the second driver, which actually contributes also to global inequality. And the third driver is a very important one, is what happens to the growth rates of populous and poor countries, in particular China and India. And in that sense, it is useful to think of the triangle, what I call the triangle, the relationship between U.S., China, and India, because they determine to a large extent what happens to the world. So basically, to summarize, there are three drivers. First, do poor countries grow faster than the rich? Second, are inequalities increasing in generally in all countries or not? And third, is China and India growing faster than the U.S.? Mm-hmm.
Why does your work matter? Why do we need to have this conversation? Why should we listen to someone who researches this? What does it matter whether one country has more inequality than the other compared to ours?
Well, it matters a lot because, inequality can be thought, and actually there are empirical studies to show that inequality is related, first, to the growth rates of the economies, secondly, to many other aspects of the economies. For example, it could be crime, morbidity rates, mortality rates, corruption, in political instability, and so on. So there is, I think, no doubt that inequality within nations does have a profound effect on its economic health, but also on the social indicators.
What do you see is lining up, for instance, when we get greater inequality? What social indicators also rise with that?
Well, clearly we cannot always have the same result. For example, one indicator that is generally thought to be actually correlated with inequality is, I suppose, the crime rate. But we know in the U.S. actually the crime rate has gone down. So it does not always work, together that you can explain it immediately, because there are many other factors which also affect the crime rate. But generally speaking, we find that social indicators which are negative and which would go with high inequality are political instability, because that obviously leads in many cases to a conflict between the rich and the poor. Actually, you can take Ukraine as a good example of that, a country with very high inequality, huge split between the billionaires and the rest of the population, high unemployment rates. So these are all things which obviously provide a very explosive cocktail. Mm-hmm. And then other things like, for example, mortality and morbidity, because they go together with people being poor and unable to afford health care or, taking very unhealthy lifestyles.
It's interesting. You mentioned Ukraine. I wonder if you look back historically and you measure inequality, if there's a level of inequality that more or less predicts when there will be political instability.
That's also very difficult to put a number on it. For instance, it is a reasonable number that the Chinese have recently been using to say if the Gini coefficient is over 40, that indicates kind of an overheated economy, if you can call it like that, in terms of inequality. Certainly nothing happens immediately when that number goes over 40 or maybe 43 or 45. I mean, Brazil has had inequality over 50 or even 60 for 30 years. It is going down now, but of course, nevertheless, Brazil has been a fairly stable democracy over that whole period, not the whole 30 years, but certainly after the return of democracy 25 years ago. So it's not something which you can immediately predict, but I think what the Chinese have been doing in a semi sort of official press and so on is to point out that when you have large countries going with the Gini coefficient over 40, it is a sort of time to a little bit look around and to be concerned.
Can a country be in very good economic health with a high, what was the term you used?
A high Gini coefficient.
When that efficient is very high, 60 or 70, can the country still be in good economic health?
That coefficient is like a measure of inequality, like you have Fahrenheit scale that measures temperature. It's really basically the same. So what you're asking me is, can a country have really very high inequality, which would be 60 or 70? Actually, no country has 70. It's, countries generally sort of top max out, it's around 60. And being in good economic health. I think it's kind of difficult because what happens is that essentially you have an elite capture of the political system and economic system and maintenance of that monopoly on power and wealth by that same group. So it's kind of hard at that high level of inequalities to see the countries that are successful. But, when you go to lower levels, it's like, maybe 40, Gini of 40, you can actually have the differences between the countries. And again, to go back to the Fahrenheit scale, your question I would translate, it's like, can you feel comfortable and nice if the outside temperature is 110 degrees? kind of unlikely that you're going to feel really great with 110 degrees. Mm-hmm. But if you ask me a question, can you feel comfortable if the outside temperature is 75 or 80, I can tell, well, depends. Some people find it too hot, other people find it fine. So that's how it is with the Gini coefficient as well.
Okay. So tell us, briefly, name some countries that are very hot, if we want to go with the temperature thing, that are very high in inequality, and then also the very cold ones, the ones that have a relative equality.
Yeah, the hot, like very high inequality countries would be typically Latin America. That was a historical case. And although, as I said before, Brazil is now reducing inequality, these are countries with very, very high inequality. Central American countries in particular, Nicaragua, Honduras, El Salvador, are countries with very high inequality. But as I said, so is Brazil, so is Peru. Colombia is now the champion of inequality in Latin America and one of the most unequal countries in the world. Then you have also African countries. You have countries, like, for example, another example which is extreme is Equatorial Guinea, which is a tiny country which depends on oil, and practically lots of income, or entirely the entirety of the income of oil, is appropriated by one family. So these are really the extreme cases. And then when you go to the cold countries, which are countries with low inequality, which are very egalitarian, you essentially have two groups of countries there. You have Central European countries like Austria, Hungary, Czech Republic, Slovakia, and Slovenia, these five very interesting small countries in Central Europe. And then you have Nordic countries like Sweden and Finland. So that's basically your story on very equal countries.
Mm-hmm. And the United States is somewhere in the middle there.
Yeah, between the two, yes. U.S. would be between the two. You know, there is an interesting sort of a comparison to make. If you take Europe generally, the countries in Europe, as we know, are less unequal than the U.S. Take U.K., which is actually quite unequal within Europe, and assume U.K. is like the 51st state of the United States. Well, U.K. would be relatively egalitarian within the U.S. framework. Then take the most unequal U.S. state, or one of the most unequal, Texas and Canada. Okay, I'm sorry, California, and assume that they are part of Latin America. Well, they would be fairly equal within Latin America. So that shows you the position of the U.S. It's actually between Europe and Latin America.
If you've just joined us, my guest this half hour is Branko Milanović. He is a lead economist in the World Bank's research department, where he works on the topics of income inequality and globalization. He'll be speaking next Monday evening, March 10th, at Drake University. You like to use stories to illustrate your point, stories from history, from literature, and stories out of the news. Do you have a story or two for us?
Well, since you mentioned it at the beginning, I have a story when, of course, people ask me who was the richest man ever, or richest person, rather. And then, of course, I have to make a caveat that we cannot, and I don't want to look into the wealth of people who were rulers, because the problem with rulers is really you cannot distinguish private wealth from the wealth of the country. So basically they treat state coffers like their own, so we really cannot compare them. But then we can say, okay, who were the richest people in history who were not the rulers, so that actually they had their own private wealth? And clearly I don't know all the people who have existed who have been rich, but then if you take some examples of people that we know have been very rich at the time where they lived, the interesting part there is that if you measure it by their ability to buy labor at that time when they lived in the developed country where they lived, then John Rockefeller turns out to have been the wealthiest in history, even wealthier than Gates. But then if you measure it by their ability to buy labor in the country where they live, then Carlos Slim turns out to have been the wealthiest.
Mm-hmm. Now, Bill Gates, yes, recently we heard him in the news, the top of a list of richest Americans, over $70 billion to his name. If you want to be born rich, which country should you be born in, if you had to pick a country?
Well, in principle, it's always good for you to be born in a richer country because you're going to benefit from that from many other aspects. Even if your parents are relatively poor in a rich country, you would probably do well because there will be system, whether it is public education or public health or actually other things that would allow you to do better. So in principle, that's the case. then you would also like to be born in a rich country that is fairly egalitarian, because that would guarantee you that you would have that. In other words, let's suppose for the sake of the argument that U.S. and Sweden are exactly the same income level and you don't know where you're going to be born, but you are risk-averse, then you would probably choose, if you could as a child, obviously, you would probably choose maybe Sweden, because you know there for sure you're going to have, you know, good health and education. Maybe you'll be able to sort of climb the ladders much more easily or faster than the U.S. So, and the third element is actually you would choose a country where there is a mobility in social position. Again, if you're risk-averse and you don't know where you're going to end up. But let's suppose that you actually believe you're going to end up really in a very rich family, then of course maybe you should choose a very egalitarian country, because then you will be at the top.
When we look back in history, not too far back in the 20th century, we see methods or attempts to tackle inequality. Marxism jumps to mind. How should we think about Marxism in our modern world?
You know, Marxism actually and communism are very sort of tricky things to put in this framework. And for example, that's where I totally disagree with, you know, most recent books, for example, with Acemoglu and Robinson, that talk about redistribution and inequality without really mentioning the most important historical movement towards equality, which was Marxism. What was special about communism is to combine two things that are very seldom or almost never found. It combines a centralized political power or autocracy or sort of power of the few with very high inequality. That's very difficult to find. You generally find that people who have political power have also wealth. But in communism, that link was severed, was cut. So that was actually very interesting. You have a group of people who are very powerful, recruited, of course, fairly broadly, because there was not the ability to sort of convey wealth to the next generations. But then they are powerful politically, but they don't have economic power. So that's very unusual. And, of course, their book does not address that issue at all.
Mm-hmm. But then later on, as Marxism, Leninism, and communist states progressed, the people in political power had a great deal of wealth, didn't they?
No, they didn't. No.
Relatively speaking, they did not.
No. It's actually, we have empirical studies, a lot of them. These people really, their wealth is actually, it seemed like that because they, of course, had the German cars, not East German cars. But, you know, it was really by comparison to what people in capitalist countries at their level of income, like the top 1% have, this was nothing. Moreover, they could not transfer that wealth to their kids, because wealth was often time, actually, for example, the duchess and the houses which were given to them in terms of their function. They were not theirs. They were there while they were in power, which was, of course, a way to control that they also be obedient to the power. Because if your house depends on you being in a job and it's taken away from you when the job is gone, then, of course, you have high incentive to toe the line.
Mm-hmm. Where are the poorest people in the world? What countries?
Oh, the poorest people in the world, of course, are in the poorest countries generally, but also in countries that we talked about, which are actually success cases, but they have huge number of poor people still, like India, for example, is a good example. People talk about India, and it is a huge success case, but India is still, in terms of really very poor people, the country with the largest number of poor people. For example, at the $2 a day, India has as many poor people, which are below that poverty line, as all of sub-Saharan Africa. So we find the poorest people in the world. We find them in obviously in Africa, in India. We also find some of them in Brazil as well. Brazil, very, very poor people in Brazil are really also at the bottom of the world.
Knowing so much about inequality in the world and in individual countries, I wonder if you hear claims or arguments in the media from, I guess, politicians perhaps, about inequality that simply don't square with the facts and the research that you've looked at?
Well, that's a difficult question. You're asking me a difficult question there. I think actually I find sometimes, I would not say totally, there are sometimes false, but not so many false. It's actually sort of drawing conclusions that are unbalanced or they're really are, how should I say, not supported by the data. So that, actually, I think I find it. For example, people sometimes talk how high are tax rates in the U.S. on the rich people now, but of course, historically, we are really at a position where the tax rates have never been lower, and actually, it's very nicely documented in Piketty's book. You know, marginal tax rates used to be 90%, 80%, and so on. They're now gone half that amount. I mean, people simply either pretend to ignore the history or don't know the history. I mean, they don't know actually that, for example, when Reagan was campaigning, he was campaigning for the equalization of tax on capital and labor, which from today's perspective would seem like almost socialist. So you would say, actually, if Reagan were to reappear today, they would actually say, well, this is really socialism. So people just say things like that. Sometimes I'm not sure if they know the history, and sometimes maybe they just prefer not to know.
We have about a minute left. What do you see when you look at the future of inequality on our earth and in our country here? Will the gap widen even further in the world, or does it sort of a pendulum going back and forth in various countries? Is there a trend?
You know, it's easier to speak of the countries, and actually if I take China and the U.S. as the two most important countries and most interesting from the point of view of inequality, I am a little bit skeptical that we would see a decline in either of them. In the U.S., I'm skeptical because I don't see the political willingness to tackle inequality, which really has to go through the Congress and reduction and change in the tax policy, increase in social transfers and expenditures on infrastructure, education, and so forth. And likewise, in China, I don't see it because, again, the system has become fairly sort of firm in that sense that people who are benefiting from inequality, oftentimes also from corruption, are the people who are in power. So in these two countries, I'm really a little bit pessimistic.
Okay, Branko Milanovic, thank you for joining us. World Bank economist, development specialist, and one of the world's leading experts on wealth, poverty, and the gap that separates them. Branko Milanovic will be speaking next Monday evening, March 10th, at Drake University. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me. It was a pleasure.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Technical support from Dennis Reese. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Catherine Perkins. Podcasting and on-demand audio available at iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music is written and performed by the River Monks. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Make sure you tune in tomorrow, a News Buzz edition of River to River coming your way. Thanks for joining us.